I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
You're listening to Pandemic, a podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungine, and each week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. Sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat. The correspondents and I will be recording this in many cases on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Thursday, May 20th, as we record this episode 87 of Pandemic. Now, if you heard the episode before last from late April, the journalist from Gaza who spoke to us, Fadi Hanona, is safe and well, although the street on which he lives was bombed. If you haven't heard that episode, it's worth a listen back. It was recorded, obviously, before the upsurge in violence that's going on as we record this. This week, we're going to look at a report by the Independent Panel on Pandemic Preparedness and Response. It came out last week. It will be presented to health ministers of WHO member countries at the World Health Assembly next week. The Independent Panel was formed after last year's World Health Assembly. At that critical time, the US under Donald Trump had withdrawn funding to the World Health Organization, as well as fiercely criticizing the global body. The WHO decided to have a look-back exercise and tasked the independent panel with looking at how member countries had performed in dealing with the pandemic, how the WHO itself had performed, and what might be done to prevent global fatalities at the level of which we've seen them over the last year or so, disruption and economic damage, whenever the next serious outbreak of a virus occurs. So in summary, the report of the panel says that a precautionary principle should be applied the next time a virus of concern emerges. Human-to-human transmission should be assumed at the outset. Action should be taken as soon as a public health emergency of international concern is notified to the WHO. And wealthier countries need to provide substantial and rapid help to less developed countries to aid their current response to the pandemic and their future preparedness for whatever might come. This pandemic should be treated, as you'll hear from the panel member we're going to interview, as the Chernobyl moment in global infectious disease response. The panel member we're going to hear from is Dr. Joanne Liu, an associate professor of paediatric emergency medicine and a former president of the organization Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières. Thanks very much, Dr. Joanne Liu. Thanks for joining us on the Pandemic podcast.
Thank you very much.
The independent panel released a report last week. It's very critical of the international response to the pandemic. Could the pandemic have been mitigated had the global response been different? I suppose, to put it a different way, could it have been like SARS or MERS and relatively localized if the world had better prepared for a pandemic?
So basically what the panel is saying in terms of his key finding is, basically, the world was not ready. We actually didn't learn much from previous localized epidemic or regional epidemic. And then we lost some very, very precious time at the beginning of this pandemic in terms of detection, in terms of declaration of a public health emergency of international concern. But first and foremost, at the national level response. And we think that the month of February 2020 was a lost month, where many countries, except a handful of countries in Southeast Asia, basically sat on their hands between 4 to 6 weeks, waiting to see what will happen. It's what we call the wait-and-see approach.
And the countries that you mentioned, I mean, I think South Korea was lauded as having taken a very proactive response. They had been impacted badly by the MERS outbreak, and that had hit their tourism and hospitality industry. Taiwan also had a good response to it. And even Vietnam, which would have had very few resources, still mounted a very comprehensive quarantining and contact tracing effort. But was that the key to it? They had all had experiences of previous respiratory epidemics. Is that where the difference lies between their approach and the approaches of other countries?
There is some of that in terms of the fact that they have this past recent experience, and so therefore they were basically ready to respond to a certain extent in that kind of mindset. The other thing that emerged in terms of findings of countries who have fared better than others is the fact that at the outset, they really, really lean towards an approach of aggressive containment of the virus. And so some of them were helped by the geography because they were island. You can think, you know, of New Zealand and Australia. But it is a question of as well of an approach of saying we need to aggressively contain it before the what we call the community transmission is so widespread that it's going to be really, really hard to follow through every single cases in terms of contact tracing.
Okay. If we begin, I suppose, with where it is widely assumed the virus broke out in Wuhan in China, in terms of notifying the World Health Organization early that this was a disease of concern, what did the panel find with regard to that early notification or that early handling of COVID-19 being found?
I think for the early handling, what was quite, I would say, emerging from our discussion and bring on the data we were gathering is the fact that fairly early on with the, I would say, the cluster of atypical pneumonia, it became very, very clear early on that the human-to-human transmission was quite a possibility. And so one of the things that the panel is putting forward is why did the precautionary principle was not applied? Meaning that in an emerging infectious disease, when you know that you are basically in uncharted water, then we think that as soon as there were doubt about human-to-human transmission, instead of downplaying it, a precautionary principle should have been applied, meaning that we don't have all the full evidence, but it leans toward that. So therefore, we should be more careful than less careful. And this is one of the things that I think that was not, I would say, forcefully transmitted by then.
Okay, so if there isn't sufficient evidence to say that there is human-to-human transmission, but there is evidence that it is more widespread in the community than a number of isolated cases, behave as if there is human-to-human transmission and contact the World Health Organization to say that that would be a legitimate concern. Would that be, I suppose, the approach you're recommending?
Yeah, that is the approach that we are recommending as a panel. And I think it is like this for any type of guidance or communication. And then I would say the flip side of that, which is what people have been saying, but then it means that we're always going to be closing down the world. I don't think it is like this. I think we can use our basic common sense. But I think it's better to be more prudent than not enough. And we will be faced with that every time we're going to have an emerging infectious disease, a novel pathogen, because we're going to be learning as we are going along. And so if we are not more precautious, if we don't apply the precautionary principle, we're probably going to be running after a virus that is spreading faster than our response.
You say that there was an absence of global leadership, or rather, to quote the report, coordinated global leadership was absent. You said global tensions undermined multilateral institutions and cooperative action. It seems that's shorthand for saying President Trump's attitude towards the World Health Organization was less than helpful at a time of crisis.
Well, I think that this could be an aspect of the issue, but I think it's more like, generally speaking, when you look at some sort of natural regional solidarity that should have enacted itself, it didn't really happen. If you took for Europe, for example, the EU, they only came together much later on. You know, it's a bit striking that this was not applied early on. I mean, as a group, you know, can we get vaccine together? Can we get the Belvazor? Can we help each other? Can we make sure that if there's some surplus somewhere, we can give it to our fellow other country a few kilometers away from us. And then we see that everywhere that didn't really happen. So the system as a whole didn't work as a system.
The other thing that you find is February was a lost month, that countries, as you say yourself, took a wait and see approach. And it's interesting, I think at the Munich Security Conference, Dr. Tedros of the World Health Organization told the audience that for too long the world operated on a cycle, this is a quote, of panic and neglect. We throw money at an outbreak and when it's over we forget about it and do nothing to prevent the next one. The world spends billions of dollars preparing for terrorist attacks attacks, but relatively little preparing for the attack of a virus which could be far more deadly and far more damaging economically, politically and socially. This is frankly difficult to understand and dangerously short-sighted. This was at the beginning, I think, of February, and still the wait-and-see approach was taken. Are you any closer to understanding why countries did that? Was it economic considerations or simply denial that they thought previous outbreaks of respiratory illnesses had happened in Asia and that it just won't happen here? And I mean, you know, Western countries in adopting that attitude.
I think that what is the panel is saying is the fact that countries who didn't fare well, they were like what we call the D issue in terms of devaluing the science, denial about what was happening, distrust, rampant distrust. So that's one thing. But I think that, and this is what we're trying to address in our recommendation, it's more of how do people, states, generally, are perceiving the threat of pandemics. And this is why we call it, this should be the Chernobyl moment of the 21st century. We need to rank and raise the threat of pandemic to the level of other existential threat, like a nuclear accident, like a weapon, a chemical weapon. This is where it needs to stand. And I think that if we were there in terms of the ranking, I think then the rest will ensue more naturally in terms of paying attention and having a sustained attention to this issue. But I think that before COVID-19, the threat of pandemic was not really felt. And so therefore, the action that should have followed through did not happen.
There was a previous report, I think, released in 2017 by a group called the International Working Group on Financing Preparedness. It's a combination of the World Bank, the IMF, governments, universities, business foundations. And one of their recommendations was that when considering the creditworthiness of a country, their pandemic readiness should be one of the criteria that's assessed. And as a result, the finance ministries in countries would pay attention to pandemic preparedness and it wouldn't be solely left to health ministries. Is that something that the panel would support, or did they look at a related issue and include it in the recommendations?
Well, somehow, you know, our recommendation is echoing some of that, because one of the things we were saying is we need to raise the threat of pandemic. And this is why we're calling to bring together a global health threat council at head of state level, because we think it's far beyond the Ministry of Health in terms of tackling the issue and responding to it. It's multi-sectorial impact, need a multi-sectorial response. And this can only be commanded from the head of state to a certain extent. And so this is why a global health threats council should be at the level of the leader of a country. This will address in terms of raising the ranking of the threat, but making sure that resources will ensue in a consequential way.
Now, you also recommend that the WHO should develop a roadmap with clear goals and targets, but I suppose that we do have the international health regulations at the moment that have been around since 2005, which call on countries to have, I suppose, situation planning, live exercises, simulation exercises, to have pandemic plans in place, to submit assessments of their own levels of preparedness. What steps or what powers do you think the WHO should have to have oversight of the implementation of the international health regulations and to make sure that countries are meeting benchmarks or are helped to meet benchmarks in the cases of countries that have less resources or fewer resources, should I say, at their disposal?
Well, in terms of our recommendation, I think we were quite clear that we believe that the WHO should play a central role in terms of bringing accountability and ensuring that people are reaching the desired goal in terms of preparedness and response. So for us, there's no doubt about it. But I think that one of the things that was clear as well is to give guidance with respect of what kind of strategic goal are we looking at. Because right now it's been more like, here's the tools that we have in our toolbox. We have vaccines, we have a therapeutic solution, dexamethasone, and then oxygen, and we have some diagnostic tests. But there needs as well to be more guidance in terms of what are we looking at? Are we looking for elimination, aggressive containment of the virus? Are we looking into a mitigation of the virus? And then to which extent do we want to go? Do we want a level of, for example, of community transmission with an R naught below 1, below 0.8, which is all different, I would say, level of transmission in the community? I think this guidance needs to be a little bit more clearer than what it has been so far.
Right. So the New Zealand approach, which was to go after zero COVID, suited them, as you mentioned earlier, for geographic reasons. And then there was some debate in other countries as to whether or not people should adopt a living with COVID or harsh lockdown. You think there should be at least some best practice that takes into account national needs, but at least guidance should be given on what the best way to deal with a pandemic is?
Absolutely. I think that we need to have a WHO who is able to basically give guidance on what is the best practices according to context.
You have an interesting recommendation. One of them is an ability to pay formula adopted where larger, wealthier economies will pay for, will help out obviously less wealthy. But it's interesting that you don't want this to be a zero-sum game with existing aid and development budgets. You want this in addition to overseas development aid budgets.
Yes, the reason why is you don't want to basically strip the budget for aid to bring it in pandemic and vice versa. So and we think that today investing on preparedness and response for pandemic is an investment. It's not a cost per se, because we know it will happen again. We know how devastating it is. You know, for example, we know that for 2020, the loss in GDP is 20 trillions. And then we expect the forecasted loss for up to 2025 would be 22 trillions. So we think that by investing billions, we're going to save trillions down the road. And it is worth it, not only for the money, but for our will, the impact on our lives, the impact on our livelihood, the impacts on our professional life, the impact on the thrive and the prosperity of a country.
Okay. And just, I suppose, to stay with the theme of those who are better able to help, helping those who have fewer resources at their disposal, the World Trade Organization and WHO should convene, and this is a quote from one of your recommendations, should convene major vaccine producing countries and manufacturers to agree to voluntary licensing and technology transfer for COVID-19 vaccines. And then you have, I suppose that's the recommendation, but there's an element of carrot and stick here, but particularly the stick. If actions do not occur within 3 months, a waiver of intellectual property rights under the agreement on trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights should come into force immediately. Would that be down to the WHO to impose that, or is this by agreement?
This is quite a technical thing, but I think it would be by agreement. I think it's a bit over. The thing is, we wanted to put pressure, and we wanted people to just say that these are recommendations. So it's as you know, it's there, but how can it be enforced? But the reality is, we're dealing with a crisis right now. We have countries who are in the thick of it, where like by thousands people are dying. And we wanted to bring the sense of urgency that it needs to happen now if we want to save lives, but if we want as well to make sure that we don't have a virus like COVID-19 running loose and mutating, and then to mutate enough that it will evade the vaccine that we have right now. And this is why, although it's being over and over and overused of we're not safe until everybody is all safe, is it's true. And so if it's not happening, then we need to enforce voluntary licensing. Okay. Otherwise, we will not get at the finish line all of us at the same time. And we there's going to be a price. It's going to come back and knock us at our door in a new variant of concern form.
So next, I think next Monday it is, the World Health Assembly is kicking off. I think it run for a week, and the panel will be presenting the findings and recommendations of its report at that. What would you like to see the response be? And I suppose if you were to pick, you yourself are an expert in pediatric medicine and of our former president of Médecins Sans Frontières. So if you were to pick your favorite recommendation or your key recommendation area, what would that be and what would you like this response to it to be?
Well, I think at the very least, I want that the immediate calls that we have in terms of vaccine redistribution and then commitment to increase manufacturing capacity in different parts of the world and the financing of the platform ACTA need to be done and commitment to do it to do this would be for me the strict minimum. Because it's we need to act now. That's for me the minimum. Then in terms of, because the set of recommendation is you have the immediate call and then the one in the future. And a lot of people are having difficulty to project themselves in the future because they say we're still in it. So we need to, well, okay, I agree. So if we're still in it, then apply the immediate call that we're asking for.
Okay, and the ACTA that you mentioned there, this is the exchange of technologies to cope with pandemics, is it?
Yes. So the thing is right now is there would be no magic wand in terms of having more vaccine to a certain extent. But we know there's been some pre-order of vaccine and there's some countries who have more vaccine than the number of citizens in their country. So we are asking those wealthy countries, please share your surplus of vaccine now when people need it because it can make a difference in people's life and commit at the latest by September 1st. That's one thing. But then in addition to that, we're saying we need to foster for increased manufacturing capacity as well now because the reality is we might be in the pretty much foreseeable near future of having to produce 7 billion to 15 billion on a yearly basis vaccine for COVID-19 if it becomes endemic.
And you have a kind of a pretty hard figure put on that. You say G7 countries should immediately commit to provide 60% of the 19 billion required for those needs in 2021. I mean, I suppose in terms of your own expectation, and I know you've worked in some pretty difficult situations and you've seen, you know, I suppose the sharp end of how sometimes wealthier countries behave towards less wealthy countries in your work with Médecins Sans Frontières. So I suppose I'd like to gauge your level of expectation or optimism because we've had previous reports. We've had the Global Preparedness and Monitoring Board's report in 2019. That's a combination of the World Bank and the WHO, which made pandemic preparedness recommendations. We had the one I mentioned earlier, the International Working Group on Financing Preparedness in 2017. We have the international health regulations, which have been in place since 2005. All of these warnings weren't heeded up until the point that this pandemic broke out. Would you be more optimistic that the findings and the consequent recommendations you've come up with would be accepted and embedded around the world following the experience of this pandemic?
That's a great question, but the reality is you're absolutely right. There's been 11 panels and commission on pandemic and trying to harness the lesson to be learned. And less than 10% of those recommendations were implemented. So the reality is, yes, we are not short of recommendation. We are short of action. Will this report be the report that will bring action to the front? I hope so. But, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic because when was the last time that the world ceased to be the world in action like it was in 2020. And you know what? In my recent history memory over the last few decades, we never had such an event where, you know, we stop living, we stop working the way we used to work. We have loved ones dying alone in hospital bed. And we had extra morbidity and people intubated for days, if not months. Do we want to go through that again? Is my question. And for me, if it's not now, I don't know when it will be. And I know that there is pressure to forget because for a lot of people, 2020 was the annus horribilis. But I'm begging the world right now. My plea is this cannot become, as high-income countries are pulling themselves out of the grip of COVID-19 because they get their community, their people vaccinated, it cannot become the neglected pandemic of the low and middle income country. It cannot become the pandemic of the poor. And it is in our hand to make sure it doesn't happen again. And so I think it is within our reach to make this not happening.
If not now, when? If not who? Us, as far as richer countries goes.
Yes, 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 absolutely, yes. I don't know what to tell your audience, you know, to convince them that it needs to happen now. But we all know that the way the world is interacting right now, we know there's going to be another as well pandemic if we don't embrace some of the recommendations, the set of recommendations we're giving, because the pressure we do on our environment. So there's going to be other outbreaks. And we believe that it is within our reach if we apply the package that we're offering to prevent an outbreak to become a pandemic. This is us who can do that.
Okay, Dr. Joanne Liu, thanks very much. You've been more than generous with your time and appreciate you joining us on the Pandemic Podcast.
All right, okay, thank you very much.
And that's it for another episode. Feel free to leave us a review on your podcast platform of choice or get in touch with me on colum.omongain@rte.ie. That's colum.omongain@rte.ie or on Twitter @ColumOmongain. We're back next week with more. Until then, stay safe and thanks for listening.